Do you have to run to be fit?
Should men be screened for prostate cancer?
At all, I would add. Sorry, couldn't help it. What is it about red meat that may be troublesome?
And using state laws and eating patterns to affect childhood obesity.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly update on the breaking medical news from Johns Hopkins. That's for April 12th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, I hardly know where to start this week, but I'm going to start with the one from a journal we've never talked about. And that's this issue of walking versus running. Do you have to run to be fit? That's in Arteriosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology.
We know, without a doubt, that exercise can beneficially affect cardiovascular risk factors. But what kind of exercise does one need to do? Does it need to be vigorous or moderate? So this is a really interesting study because they actually used two different cohorts, a national runners cohort of over 33,000 individuals and a walkers cohort of about 16,000 individuals. And they matched equivalent energy expenditures. You expend about twice as much energy for the duration of running that you do with walking. But if you match the total amount of expenditures, you get equivalent benefits. And when they examined these 48,000 individuals, what they found was that there was equivalent energy expenditures by moderate exercise, walking, or vigorous exercise, running, produced similar risk reductions in high blood pressure, cholesterol, and diabetes. What that tells me is you can pick the exercise that you most enjoy doing.
This is good news, of course, for those folks who always give themselves the excuse that, oh, I really just despise running. It's really no fun. All of us walk a lot of the time, or I say all of us, not all of us, but most of us do. So it kind of removes one barrier, at least in my mind, from this. I would ask a question, though, about cardiovascular fitness. And I guess in this cohort, they didn't really take a close look at that. Things like VO2 max, for example, which we know are improved with running versus walking.
Right. And it's interesting. I'm going to call that a surrogate endpoint. What this study addressed was exercise reducing cardiovascular risk, actually coronary heart disease incidence. So I'd say I'm really more interested in that than in what your level of oxygen consumption or VO2 max or fitness is.
Yeah. Well, speaking as a fellow nerd, I also happen to know that you've got quite a robust computer on your bicycle and you're looking at those numbers just the way I am. Since we're talking about cardiovascular fitness then, let's turn to this very interesting and provocative study in Nature Medicine, a look at something called carnitine and its relationship to red meat consumption.
For me, Elizabeth, this came out of the clear blue. I was surprised. We know that high levels of meat consumption in the developed world are linked to cardiovascular disease risk. And people assumed, well, it's due to saturated fats and cholesterol in the meat. When you actually look at the amount of cholesterol and saturated fats in the meat, it can't really explain fully the increased cardiovascular disease risk. So what these investigators did was said, gosh, there must be some other factors that could contribute to that. And they reasoned that one possible explanation was this compound called carnitine. And they kind of came through a back door. There was a related dietary supplement called choline. They know when it was metabolized in the gut to something called trimethylamine N-oxide. We're going to call that TMAO. This metabolite produced in the gut actually increases the risk of atherogenesis in mice. So they took a group of meat eaters and they compared them to vegans. And the first thing they found was that the levels of carnitine and TMAO are higher in vegans than they were in omnivores. And then they challenged each of these individuals. They gave them high dietary supplements. And the omnivores increased the levels of TMAO. The vegans did not. They took the omnivores, they put them on antibiotics. And when they did, that is, they changed the gut flora, they no longer had high levels of TMAO. And then they took almost 2,600 individuals that had undergone cardiac catheterization. And so they knew whether they had blockages in their arteries, and they recognized that high levels of carnitine, especially in individuals with high levels of TMAO, also were associated with increased risk of coronary artery disease. So this is a tremendous amount of circumstantial evidence suggesting that carnitine in diet, which is high in meats, may be responsible for the increased risk of cardiovascular disease. There are a lot of supplements now on the market that are high in carnitine, so that may not be such a good idea after all.
Of course, we know that what we really need is our randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial to see whether or not the administration of carnitine results in increased atherosclerosis or some other surrogate endpoint, to use your phraseology, like C-reactive protein or something else, some other likely culprit. For right now, I would ask you, you probably already minimized your consumption of red meat, although you are there in that great state of Texas. So what would you say for most people? Should they think about this when they're thinking about their diet?
Elizabeth, I must admit, I was nailed. I had a good steak last night. But in fairness, I only do that about once every couple months. Regardless of what the underlying cause is, I think we have very good data showing that high levels of meat consumption are associated with cardiovascular disease. I would say for those people that are taking dietary carnitine, this raises some concerns in my mind.
Well, I guess we're going to keep on looking for the smoking gun, or maybe we have one. Let's see if we use it in another way. It turns out to really be the smoking gun. From here then, why don't we turn to something I disparaged when you suggested it, but I think we just got to do it. And that's prostate cancer screening, PSA screening in men in Annals of Internal Medicine, the recommendations of the American College of Physicians.
What they're suggesting is for men under the age of 50 and over the age of 69, or men that have a life expectancy of less than 10 to 15 years, there should be no PSA screening. That's assuming they're not high risk. They don't have two first-degree relatives that have had prostate cancer before the age of 65. What about those men between the ages of 50 and 69? You shouldn't routinely do it. This guideline actually gives the physician talking points, things that you should tell the patient, like the chances of harm from screening with PSA might outweigh the chances of benefit. The vast majority of prostate cancer is slow growing and does not cause death. PSA doesn't distinguish between prostate cancer that's serious and prostate cancer that's not. And that by screening, you prevent at most one death for every 1,000 men screened after 11 years of follow-up. That the treatment oftentimes is administered to men who would never have problems, and it can result in sexual dysfunction in about 37% of men, difficulty with control of urination in 11%, and a small risk of death. So after all that, the patient should tell the physician, yes, I want it, or no, I don't want it.
Pretty persuasive argument for, hey, let's just forget about this, I would say. But I would also say that for the 1 in 1,000 men for whom prostate cancer is a problem, then the incidence is 100%. These things are really great for professionals and for informing discussions like ours. But for a man who's sitting in front of you, who's asking you, hey, should I do this or shouldn't I? I'm not sure it is that informative.
It gives them as much information as possible. Oftentimes when you give the patient the information, they look back at the physician and say, what would you do?
And so I'm going to ask you to reiterate once again what your own standpoint on this is for your personal health.
As you know, I fall in the 50 to 69-year-old range, for the younger part of that, I might add, by the way, to our listeners. And I've decided not to have PSA screening.
And finally, I would just add that I recently spoke with one of our prostate cancer experts here at Johns Hopkins, Ballantyne Carter, about the range of genetic tests that are out there right now purporting to help predict a man's risk when he has had a prostate biopsy. He says very clearly, don't do it. At this point, they're not worth the money. So I just want to add that as a little public health message. Finally, then, we're going to treat two studies together, one from pediatrics and one from JAMA Pediatrics, looking at adolescent weight, childhood obesity, eating frequency, and school meals. You see, I put them all together for you, lucky thing.
Thanks. In the U.S., a national school lunch program was established in 1946 to improve students' nutritional intake. And currently, we have about 32 million children that receive these lunches. In 2012, they established guidelines that describe what the diet should be: increases in fruits and vegetables and whole grains, and reduction in trans fat content and limits on calories. And they determined that there was a significant reduction, about a 12.3% smaller incidence of obesity in states that actually adhered or exceeded the USDA standards. The second study was a meta-analysis examined eating frequency versus overweight or being obese. When they looked at the highest category of eating frequency, kids ate 5 to 7 meals or snacks per day, and compared to the lowest risk or the lowest incidence, kids that ate 2 to 3 meals a day, there was a significant benefit. It suggests that perhaps encouraging kids to have more frequent meals or snacks can actually lower the incidence of obesity.
It seems to me that the establishment of good eating habits by carefully controlling what they eat and when they eat could help us stem this tide of obesity.
Yeah, it looks like eating meals more frequently can attenuate a lot of the postprandial metabolic and endocrine responses to dietary intake. So I thought this was pretty fascinating.
All right, and I'm just going to say for the benefit of our listeners who are not conversant with all the medicalese, that postprandial means after eating and endocrine means all those hormones that get released. On that note then, I'm going to talk about in the blog, of course, go ahead, you guess it, Rick, which is it going to be?
Carnitine.
You got it. I'm going to talk about carnitine and red meat. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.